This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of December 25th, 2022. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 270. Merry Christmas and Happy New Year. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest. I award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker. And the big deal feature, the MMA panel. I'm joined by Mario Canseco and Andy Yan to look back at some of the big stories of 2022. But first, we hear from Burnaby journalist Alfie Lau, who is back from the World Cup in Qatar. Some call it the greatest World Cup final in history, even though the first 70 minutes were really a dud, as defending champion France did not look like a defending champion, and Argentina looked like it was going to breeze to victory. But that changed in a matter of minutes, as the game did go into extra time, and it looked like Argentina was going to win that. But then it was equalized, and then it went to the penalty kick shootout. Usually the penalty kick shootout is unpopular. A lot of fans don't like it. The wrong way to end a game. But it is a moment where people, billions of people around the world, were at the edges of their seat. And one person that was on the edge of his seat, though probably standing up as well, and then sitting on the edge of his seat again, and experiencing this firsthand, among the people at Lusail Stadium in Doha, Qatar, was Alfie Lau, a veteran journalist from Burnaby, a seven-time World Cup veteran at the final, came back and is home now safe in Burnaby, back from one of the greatest sporting events, at least this year. It was also the most expensive World Cup, $220 billion to make it all happen in the desert. Also the most controversial. Qatar got this World Cup via bribery in 2010 from FIFA, moved it from the traditional June and July dates to November and December because of the heat of the desert, and was under fire for its treatment of foreign workers who came to build the stadiums and other infrastructure, and also the very conservative laws against drinking beer, and also laws against LGBTQ people. Alfie, back from this this whirlwind trip to one of the most controversial sporting events of all time, one of the most seen sports events of all time. What was Qatar like on the ground? The stadiums, the travel around Doha. This was actually a World Cup that was more like an Olympics because it was based around one metropolitan area instead of spread across a country.
Well, I mean, the great thing was the stadiums were first class. I mean, eight stadiums, seven were new, and they were soccer specific, unbelievable. So I have nothing but good to say about stadiums. Transportation, well, in engineering, they have something called the last mile problem. Well, we got really close to the stadium, all eight of them. That last mile was a problem. The walking between metro stations or where the bus dropped us off, wow, it was about an average of 30 minute walk from where the bus or metro dropped you off till you got into the stadium. Accommodations? Well, I mean, I lived in a gamut, a full gamut. So for the final, I was staying on one of the cruise ships that was docked in Doha Harbor there, right? So that was a bit of luxury, and it was a little treat to myself there. But for 10 of the days, I was staying in the Barahat Al Janoub, which was a worker's village, where the room included two beds, a locker, a bathroom, and that was it. Wasn't even a table, for God's sake. So we did 10 days in that. So the accommodation, and plus we were about 90 minutes away from civilization as well, too. So the accommodation, while safe, and there were a lot of fans staying there, so it was a good atmosphere there. We were in the middle of nowhere. We were wandering the desert looking for shuttle buses to get to somewhere nice. So, and it wasn't cheap either. I mean, it was $84 a night at the Barahat Al Janoub. Right. I mean, not terrible, but I mean, I've been to enough World Cups where, you could pay as little as $20-$30 is what we were paying in Russia. So there was nothing cheap. Well, actually, there was something cheap. Groceries were cheap. My God, I ate so well at the Carrefour grocery stores there. I mean, the deli there was fantastic. I was having a medium sized pizzas for the equivalent of $3. So Oh no, I mean it was a great experience because I mean not necessarily for us North Americans, but for the rest of the world that we don't think about. The North Africans were there in droves. So many Tunisians, so many Moroccans. There were so many people from Saudi Arabia who came over. I mean, like the complex I stayed at for 10 days, we saw 50 buses of Saudi Arabians, right? So I mean, I know how Qatar got this World Cup, and it was a bit unsavory, but I don't disagree with the fact that soccer is a world game, and you need to go to places where you don't traditionally see soccer tournaments. And yeah, so it was, I'm glad I'm home. I'm glad I went, but I'm not going back.
What did people see on the ground? What did you see on the ground there in Doha that people didn't see on TV, that people really know about, that wasn't conveyed on TV?
Oh, the sheer amount of workers who were had no training, almost no responsibility, but they were boots on the ground. So there were tons of people on the Corniche, which is the 7 kilometer sort of scenic walk along the water there. But I don't know what the responsibilities were. I mean, we talked to them, and they're mostly from India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, North Africa. And they were supposed to be helpful, but you ask them, you know, where's the metro? They point you in one direction. Where can you get an Uber? They push in the same direction, right? So there were so many people working. The staffing levels were just unbelievable, but they weren't trained. I mean, one time we got on a shuttle bus to go to Al Bayt for the England USA game. Normally should be a 90-minute drive. It took 2.5 hours because this guy beached the bus in a roundabout, and almost rear-ended a whole bunch of cars. But we got us to the game. But I can't even blame him. I mean, sounds like his only instructions were the GPS should just follow the GPS, right? But they gave him an old GPS, so he went down a road that he shouldn't been on, like a big bus roundabout. Didn't really quite make it. So I don't think you saw any of that on TV here. I mean, like the sheer amount of people working there and supposedly trying to help us out, but like under-trained, overstaffed. So that was probably the biggest thing that we saw there. And there were a lot of cultural events that were taking place that no one attended because they were all taking place while there were games on. Down in Al Wakrah, where I stayed for some of the time, they had this beautiful venue, and they were touting they had 56 concerts over the 28 days, so two a day. I don't know anyone who attended any of them. We passed by there one time, and we could see there was stuff going on, but I don't know. Again, I don't know anyone attended any cultural events at all other than the soccer. And I mean, that's what the big takeaway was, that it was such a compressed World Cup with so many games going on at the same time that all the other stuff that you want to do at World Cups, the cultural stuff, the fun stuff, there just literally was no time to go do it.
And this was also a World Cup where Canada was back. I guess before we talk about Canada's participation, first time since 1986, English language. Was there any language barrier there?
No, everyone spoke English there. I mean, it was funny. Arabic, everyone spoke Arabic and English. And it was one of the guys I traveled with that we were riding a bus with Moroccans one day, and I was just amazed. He pulled out the fluent French, and it was fantastic. But no, I mean, English was, everyone spoke it, and I mean, really no problems at all. Right.
So Canada was back for the first time since 1986. There was some reports of 25,000 Canadians going to Canada's first round matches against Belgium, Croatia, and Morocco. What was it like being there for history, to be among so many Canadians, to watch Canada's team? Of course, the results, they got a goal this time. They didn't get a win this time. That'll have to wait till 2026.
Yeah, it was pretty magical. I mean, I can vouch for it. There was 25,000 Canadians there. I mean, for those first couple days, from the 23rd of November till December 1st, there were Canadian jerseys everywhere. I mean, it was unbelievable. But that being said, I mean, there was a lot of Mexicans, a lot of Argentinians, lots of Ecuadorians. But I mean, but the red was everywhere. So I mean, it was really fantastic. And I mean, I don't want to downplay what Canada did. I mean, making a World Cup in 36 years, huge accomplishment. But we were outplayed, outcoached, out everything here. I mean, that was the saddest thing. I mean, really, John Herdman, you know, really made all the headlines with the F Croatia quote there. And you know, I mean, he got he that was the sad thing. I mean, this is a good, nice building block for Canada. I mean, for 2026, now that these guys have know what it takes to, like, it's not just a fun trip. You know, you got to get a point in your first two games. That's what Canada was unable to do. And if you don't get a point in your first two games, then your third game doesn't mean anything. So, unbelievable atmosphere. I mean, going to the metro stations to the games, I mean, just a wall of red, a sea of red. And it's weird. I mean, seven World Cups, I'd never seen Canada in one. And, I mean, even I belted out the anthem for those three games. And that was special.
So here we are, now the countdown to 2026, when the World Cup is coming to Canada for the first time, going back to the U.S. and Mexico again, the Tri-Nation World Cup in 2026. Host cities will include Vancouver, Toronto, and Seattle. So what do people here in the Vancouver area, what do listeners in Toronto and Seattle, what do they all need to know about hosting FIFA in 2026 after your experience going to so many World Cups, including this one in Qatar, which was a little bit different? What do people listening need to know about getting ready for 2026?
Bit of a crapshoot. I mean, don't expect to be getting a Germany-Spain game every day. Expect to see a lot of Tunisia versus Togo games. So, you know, it's got to keep your expectations a little bit low, especially for the Canadian games. So we're only getting 10 of the games right now of the 80, none of the knockout games. So, you know, once you get the one or two Canada games, you get two or three other games. So you're not going to see the marquee games. That being said, the World Cup is unlike any sporting event. Like the way the people travel. I mean, I was just in complete wonderment seeing, you know, like all the Ecuadorians who were going for that opening game. I mean, my flight from Miami, you know, 90% were Ecuadorians wearing yellow there. So whatever countries are playing in Vancouver, you're just going to see a wall of fans coming from whatever country it is. So, I mean, it's just unbelievable. Like, I mean, most of these countries, you know, the people are making less than we are, and they're traveling to a first world nation, so they're spending a lot of money to do this, and unbelievable. So the atmosphere is something that people really should look forward to. For people in Toronto, I'm still mystified how they expect to host the games in BMO Field. I went to BMO Field a couple years ago, 25,000 seats currently, and then they can expand it 45,000. I don't know where, right? But it's the size of that stadium just doesn't seem like what it needs to be at. I mean, both Seattle and Vancouver have big enough stadiums where they're going to get the right amount of fans for it. So, expect, you know, when the games are going on, everything in the city is going to be affected. Your transportation, your traffic, your hotels, everything. I mean, it's just a World Cup game just takes over your city for when it's taking place. And, It's a special feeling. I'll be interested to see what it's like in Seattle, Vancouver, because all these reports of guys who attended, you know, 34, 48 games. I attended 21 games. I thought that was a lot. But, you know, here are guys who attended, like, I know a guy in Ottawa attended 34, a guy in Saskatoon attended 41. Well, pretty much you look at the calendar, or you look at the map, the only place on the West Coast where you can do two in a day would be Seattle, Vancouver. Right. And you got a 3-hour drive across the international border to make that happen. So I don't think people will be too silly to do that. But it will be interesting in 2026. I mean, we're only 3.5 years away with how late this World Cup is. I mean, we're a lot closer to the next World Cup than we really should be.
Well, thanks again for joining us on the Breaker.News podcast. Alfie Lau, veteran journalist from Burnaby and a 7-time World Cup attendee. Looking forward to making 2026 in U.S., Canada, Mexico his 8th. And we'll be talking more to Alfie in 2023 as things progress with the hosting plan for the 2026 World Cup. Thanks again, Alfie. Have a Merry Christmas and Happy New Year to you.
Happy Festivus!
This is the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. Time for the last MMA panel of 2022 on the Breaker.News podcast. I'm Mackin. Joining me are Mario Canseco of Research Co. and Andy Yan from the Simon Fraser University City Program.
starting off with the local stories that made an impact in 2022. Change at city halls in BC's two biggest cities. In Vancouver, Kennedy Stewart was voted out by a big margin. The new mayor is Ken Sim and his ABC Vancouver supermajority. In Surrey, Doug McCallum and his Safe Surrey Coalition voted out by a small margin. The new mayor is Brenda Locke and Surrey Connect.
Andy, what surprised you the most of these two races that, Ken Sim won, Brenda Locke won? Was there a big surprise there? Was it really the margin of victory? Not much of a margin of victory for Brenda Locke, but a very big margin of victory for Ken Sim.
Well, I think a lot of it is the margin of victory and the location of where the support for the victory came in. I think the fact of the matter is that within the City of Vancouver elections, you really saw the rise of the southeastern neighborhoods in the City of Vancouver, where I think it's been historically kind of posed that, you know, you had the west-east kind of separation between the, you know, the more affluent west side and the working class east side. Is that I think that this election really put it on its head towards the fact that the neighborhood through which that helped define who was in council chambers and in the mayor's seat was actually the southeast corner of the city. That we're not talking about Point Grey or Kerrisdale. We're actually talking about Sunset and Killarney. Yeah. And really how, and I think a lot of this is also a testament to the hard work and money that was involved in this particular election, that ABC was able to really get their vote out, get a political machinery, I think, through which we haven't seen, I think, in a long time in this city, and really dominate both the election for the mayor and council seats. So that I think a lot of this is really perhaps the question, are we at the beginning of a political moment or of a political movement where we will see this type of, you know, new landscape of Vancouver politics come into play and really solidify itself?
Many headlines in Vancouver throughout the year, such as stranger attacks, danger in Chinatown, fires at downtown Eastside hotels, some deadly. The tenth city on the downtown east side. New Premier David Eby came in with $7 million in December for temporary modular housing with 90 units. That won't do much, especially since it's not going to open until March.
Or what do you think was the defining moment of the campaign, of what turned around things from Kennedy Stewart to Ken Sim in 2022?
I'd say more than anything, it's a manifestation of how disjointed the center-left and left vote was. You know, people who were wondering who was running for park board under Kennedy Stewart's banner. Well, no, there's nobody. Okay, so now I'm going to vote for Cope, or how come we can have a situation where everybody coalesces, or you have some of the remnants of Vision collaborating with Cope, collaborating with Kennedy Stewart's party and One City. So I think that will be the major challenge for the next one. We could be at the start of a dynasty where Ken Sim becomes the mayor and stays there for 8 or 12 years, unless the left can get its act together and try to mount a challenge that would replicate what we saw in 2002, a very well-organized effort to get everybody, to get majorities in all of the legislative bodies, and also to have a significant level of support for the mayoral candidate. They were certainly hurt by the fact that we had some sort of informal alliances. You know, vote for me, but there's a couple of friends with One City that you should also be supporting, and I also like a couple of people at Vision. And then you wound up in a situation where nobody knew who to vote for, whereas the organizational structure of ABC was such that they said, here's the slate. We have candidates running for everything, even though we said that we were going to get rid of the Parks Board, you know, vote for our Parks Board candidates. And it made a lot of sense. And this is one of the reasons why they won so handily. But a lot of the things that they campaigned on are not going to go away quickly. I think we saw a lot of supporters of ABC tweeting pictures of broken windows ad nauseum in the last 2 weeks of the campaign. Nothing has changed except the fact that these people are no longer as active on social media telling us about the problems on the downtown east side. So I think there's a hint of collaboration, the fact that we're having Ken Sim talking with David Eby, which is a blessing and a curse for the BC Liberals. You know, it's going to be tough for Kevin Falcon if an election happens next year to go, crime is a mess everywhere, but not in Vancouver, where our friends got the mayor elected.
2022 started with Kevin Falcon on a comeback in the BC Liberal leadership race, which he eventually won. There was some controversy there. It ended with Ken Sim starting off his new administration at City Hall with his ABC Vancouver supermajority. There is a common denominator.
The chief of staff, Kareem Alam, at Vancouver City Hall, the right-hand man of Ken Sim, who was the campaign manager for Kevin Falcon. Do you think that this bodes well for the BC Liberals going into 2023?
Well, it's not going to be as easy as other campaigns. I think part of what we see here is a manifestation of a lot of people who were dissatisfied with the way things were going in the city, particularly when you connect the way things were going as far as the COVID-19 pandemic and the type of relationship that we saw, for instance, the Horgan government develop with people. We didn't see anything remotely similar to that in the city of Vancouver. So that takes that argument out of the equation. But ultimately, I think it's going to be about connecting on issues, particularly healthcare. You know, to me, one of the biggest surprises of the past couple of months has been the rise of healthcare as an issue in British Columbia, particularly for those over the age of 55.
Right.
Everybody was, you know, happy to an extent with the pandemic management, so much that they ended up getting a majority out of it. But now you have the over 55 component who's waiting for that hip replacement, who's waiting for that test. Right. Saying thank you for the pandemic management. Now it's time to get the healthcare system back where it has to go. So whoever can connect better on that file will win the election. We saw it in Quebec. You know, people were very upset about healthcare, and François Legault ended up getting a new majority because he connected on that file. It wasn't about changing the guidelines for languages or separation or anything of the sort. He connected on that and he won. Similar situation in Nova Scotia, where the conservatives out-liberaled the liberals. We're going to spend like crazy so everybody gets a new hip. And they won the election. So this is part of it. It's not going to be housing. It's not going to be the environment, even though we have a lot of discussions about what the NDP could have done if they had a different leader. Whoever connects on healthcare and gets the vote of the 55 and overs, that's who will win the next election.
Much less, I think that there's also the element of sick kids that I think, remember, the pandemic isn't over. If anything, we have a tridemic, you know, a mixture of, you know, the COVID-19, of the flu, of RSV, and totally forgot what RSV stands for, but it doesn't sound great. But that really how fundamentally now we also have, I think, we got hips on one side of the question, and then also an ongoing respiratory pandemic, through which I think now has three heads it's a three-headed hydra at this point. So then I think that just really and a very, I think, stretched healthcare system, so that we very much kind of see the new rise of how healthcare, I think, could be on top of the heap, on top of affordable housing, public safety. And oh, by the way, there's this little thing called climate change that is still ongoing, so and will not disappear. So I think that this is really, I think, an interesting kind of movement towards how these four issues will not be resolved anytime soon, but yet it's giving, I think, whomever wants to be premier, much less mayor of Vancouver, a sense of direction, a sense of leadership that if you trust me and my team, I will get us to help us put us on the road towards solving these challenges.
Healthcare is one of the four H's that dog the post-Horgan NDP, including housing prices, homelessness, and hydro. That's BC Hydro, Site C, the $16 billion mega project that's doubled in price. Federally, there's another H. Earlier the year, we heard honk honk, the trucker convoy protests against vaccine mandates and pandemic restrictions. They brought Ottawa to a halt around Parliament Hill. Police were very slow to react. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau exploited allegations of right-wing extremists and invoked the Emergencies Act to get rid of the strange mix of big rigs and bouncy castles. But this was not the same as January 6, 2021, that insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. The evidence so far in the public inquiry is that the Emergencies Act was not needed, that the government overstepped its power.
Truckers that were, some of them were feeding off the conspiracies regarding vaccines, but this wasn't as bad as the Liberals had sold it early in the year. What do you think that this has done to Justin Trudeau's brand, or is this further polarized, an already polarized country? Andy?
Well, Well, I think that, I mean, it's interesting because I think one of the things I've learned, I think, within the last year was this observation. I think that there's probably, you know, many a political science thesis could be written about that. Canadians don't necessarily vote their leaders in, they vote them out. Mm-hmm. And that at all three levels of government, that the various people in and out are there because the previous regimes were voted out. And that people wanted the change. The overall electorate wanted to see a change. But I think that within this, I think it's also understanding that in the 2020s, it's not only the kind of historic discussions and debates around left and right, around conservative and liberal and that kind of various spectrums, but that really there is, I think, an understanding and a really, I think, an ongoing challenge of the ideas of the politics of recognition. That I think that we are in this really strange time, in part facilitated by technology, by social media, by really something that we haven't seen before in terms of a way of communicating a number of voices that historically haven't been heard, but yet at this, but then see a movement around the politics of recognition that. It's not that, again, this idea of larger ideas of society, but just the basic message of, I see you. And I think that it's something to actually see that in one way, Justin Trudeau has actually, you know, maybe perhaps accidentally kind of touched upon this in his campaign. But Poilievre, in listening to his speech when he won the conservative leadership, just hit it right on the head. That as his speech, I think his acceptance speech was one of, I think, tremendous, I think, power of really harnessing the ideas of the politics of recognition. The I see you, I think that I understand, I want to understand you, that I think is now so far ahead of, remember the Clinton-esque comment of I feel your pain. But it's even more basic than that. It's not even the I feel your pain or 1,000 points of light, which is like, you know, which is an incredibly sophisticated idea compared to all this, is I see you. And really how much politics will be shaped moving into the future of the simple act of saying, I see you.
When we go back to all the elections that we had federally in this century, the one party that got the largest proportion of the vote in British Columbia federally is the Canadian Alliance in 2000. Right. Nobody else has come close to that level of support. Harper won majority governments, he won minority governments. The Liberals have only been top of the charts twice in BC, 1968 and 2015, both of them with the first election under a guy named Trudeau. So I see possibilities for Poilievre to connect in a way that will allow British Columbians to support his party much more so than they did in the other two elections. I think that is going to be one of the major aspects that they need to take care of.
His connection to young people, Mario, I find really surprising and really interesting. His reach for those under 30 is something that, you know, if he was supposedly a conservative movement, that you find really surprising and really interesting to see how those under the age of 30 are recognizing Poilievre.
Well, and it's a very compelling story. You know, here's somebody who was adopted. He's married to somebody from Venezuela. You know, it's not the kind of narrative that is going to throw off people. You know, he doesn't seem to be similar to previous conservative leaders. And if they continue to connect well in Ontario, I think this could be a very interesting election. But more than anything, it's going to be, how do you establish that emotional rapport with voters, especially young voters who may not be as swayed by what happened? I mean, one of the things that made the Stockwell Day election so compelling is it's the third kick at the can for Chrétien. People are starting to get tired that, yes, he gets a majority, but because of the way the vote was split. Similar situation here. If you're getting Justin Trudeau, who suddenly looks more tired, who suddenly looks out of ideas, this is the kind of thing that can get younger voters, especially first-time voters, to connect. And this is the way Trudeau won his first minority. You know, people simply switched, especially in the urban areas. This is why Poilievre is talking about housing nonstop. He gets those votes in Toronto and in Vancouver. We could be in for a very close election seat-wise. Voting intention, we might have the same results that we did before. But if you get those breaks in the specific areas where you need them, the government could change hands.
Right. And I mean, when I studied the last federal election, it was actually really surprising to see how locked out the conservatives were in dense urban ridings. And I think that just to listen to how Poilievre has really kind of tried reaching out to those ridings, I mean, not only in Vancouver, but across the country is really, it's really interesting to watch.
Mario, do you think that this is going to be the defining issue of our times, the affordability issue, as Trudeau, of course, still wants to push issues of the environment, issues of feminism and other aspects of equity. But Pierre Poilievre, on the other side of things, is looking at affordability. How does a Canadian survive in this economy and stay ahead of the game?
It's certainly an issue that wins elections. I think there's an opportunity to try to connect very differently than he was at the start. I think those discussions that Poilievre insisted upon related to cryptocurrencies and, you know, that's way past us. I don't think that is the way in which you're going to connect with people who are worried about paying their bills. Ultimately, I think it's also about the moment when you start to have the type of campaign similar to the one Reagan had against Carter. You know, are you better off than you were 4 years ago? Is this right, the type of leadership that you believe we continue to require to go forward? Or are you ready to do something that is different? And I think a lot of that is going to be hinging upon getting people who don't usually vote liberal to look at the Conservatives as an option. Yes, there are people who are considering the Greens or the NDP who would look at the Conservatives as an option before they look at the Liberals as an option. And it's been difficult for the NDP to connect in a way that is going to win them more seats. The Greens went back to their previous leader, albeit in a shared role that is more reminiscent of the way the Greens operate in Europe. So if you're an opposition voter who is not satisfied with what Trudeau is selling, you're more likely to take a look at the Conservatives and say, okay, let's just take our chances with this guy. You know, he might not be as terrible as people make him out to be. And in that sense, the convoy could not have happened at a worse time. You know, I think the Liberals already spent all of their political capital on calling all of those people sort of remnants of the Trump era who were about to do a January 6th thing in Ottawa. You know, that's way past us. I don't think they can look into the Poilievre voter and say, you are a Trumpian, because people will forget what that was about. So you also lose that opportunity to, you know, define your rival, as Hillary Clinton would say, part of a basket of deplorables. You know, you can't do that anymore, because there will be people who voted for Trudeau and who are looking at Poilievre as an option, the same way we had people who voted for Harper and in 2015 said, not anymore.
Fundamentally, Mario, you're saying the 2010s are over and it's the 2020s are wide open. That if anything, everything that we talked about is really a summary of really what happened in the 2010s, and that we're only 2 years into the 2020s. And really, it's wide open. And then it also, it seems that Poilievre is really able and capable to kind of, I think, pull, at least help start defining really what the politics of the 2020s look like. That if the era of Trudeau was in the 2010s, I mean, he's going to have to catch up to this, to what the politics of the 2020s are.
2022 was a year of war and unrest internationally, and it had an effect on Canada. After Putin went to Beijing to forge his No Limits alliance before the Olympics with Xi Jinping, after the Olympics, he invaded Ukraine. Ukrainians have fought back against Putin with the help of the West, including many, many hundreds of millions of dollars from Canada. Meanwhile, Xi Jinping got another 5 years from the Chinese Communist Party to lead the country, the most powerful leader since Mao. China has threatened to invade Taiwan. There were anti-government protests in China in late November led by students. Then Xi ended zero COVID and let the virus spread rapidly. There are also allegations of China meddling in Canadian elections. Meanwhile, in Iran, Mahsa Amini died after arrest by the morality police for the crime of showing her hair. This sparked protests by Iranians around the world demanding an end to the Islamic dictatorship.
Which one of these was the biggest impact on Canada this year? The war in Ukraine, the headlines of Chinese interference, the Iranian-Canadians that are taking to the streets every week, it seems, here in Vancouver to seek help for their friends and family back home?
Well, I think the lasting impact, especially in the context of electoral politics, is going to be Iran. there seems to be a disconnect in the way in which governments are supposed to operate with everything that is related to the country. And to me, the biggest example of this discrepancy is the Canadian men's national soccer team announcing that they're playing Iran at BC Place. And then a couple of days later saying, oops, we didn't know we weren't supposed to invite this particular team, so we're not going to play anybody and get your refunds at your local community Ticketmaster. It was just astonishing to see such a level of detachment between an issue that is definitely complex and the way in which the bodies that were in charge of this were behaving. Now, that being said, we've spent a lot of time discussing Ukraine. I think there was an expectation that the war was not going to last as long as it has. And it has been detrimental for those who are supportive of the government that is in place right now. You know, we have all of those photo ops with the Ukrainian president. He was recently in the in Washington, D.C. with Joe Biden. So he's going to be the man of the year for Time magazine. So there's so many things at play. But people were expecting a quicker resolution to this. And you know, there's a lot of residents of this country, particularly in the prairies, who look at Ukraine as their homeland. And they're not going to be satisfied with the fact that a lot of the things that we have to show for as far as this war are photo ops where Justin Trudeau is calling Volodymyr Zelensky. You know, people were expecting something completely different from this. And I think the early stages of the war suggested that our participation was going to be much more than just we're with you and, you know, good luck. We might help you in any way we can, but it's not going to be something that will enable your victory as quickly as most of the residents of this country would hope for.
Right. Well, the winter of our greatest discontent, perhaps, that I think a lot of it is really representative of all of them, that they are, I think, presenting really the role of diasporic politics, that really how much diaspora, how much Canada is, I think, composed of peoples from around the world that ultimately have this type of relationship. I think that, if anything, touching upon the Ukrainian question, you got to remember, the first sister city for the city of Vancouver was the city of Odessa. And it kind of gives you with the kind of length and time of those types of relationships. But then at the same time, I think touching upon the Iranian question about soccer, because of course, let's face it, Mario, it's all about football or soccer, right? That's really, I think, a reminder of gender equity, of really the roles of gender, of really how I think equity for women is still something. I know, and I look at our panel and we keep ourselves in check, but that really how gender equity around the world is still one of that ongoing challenges. And I think that, you know, as much as we talk about the men's soccer, Canadian men's soccer, then that debacle, we have to remember how dominant the Canadian women's soccer team is on this planet. And we must celebrate that. And so fundamentally, that gives us that reminder within Iran, within really what's happening in Iran, not to give, I think, to present that ongoing question of gender equity. And within, I think, the Ukraine, it really touches upon really, I think, the ongoing sizable challenges in terms of global security, in terms of really what's going on there. But then I think going back to China, I think that you have to also remember that in a minority government that we are in federally, that I think that there presents, I think, some ongoing, I think, sensitivity towards the influence of not only, you know, what happens perhaps in China, but then all over the world, that we could have these nefarious, I think, possible influences that really can help shape or, I think, distort Canadian democracy. And it's something that we have to be vigilant about.
And that's it, the last MMA panel of 2022 with my guests Mario Canseco of Research Co. and Andy Yan of the Simon Fraser University City Program.
And Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Breaker.news podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim. In the Taiwan news, delegation of 12 Japan House of Councillors members to visit Taiwan. The delegation of LDP members of the House of Councillors were all considered supporters of the late Prime Minister Abe Shinzo, who achieved a large measure of popularity in Taiwan due to his statements in favor of the country in its resistance against bullying by China. During its December 26th to 29th stay, the group will visit Abe's statue in Kaohsiung City, as well as meet President Tsai Ing-wen and other government leaders, and pay its respects at the grave of President Li Teng-wei. In Kyoto news, three admit to charges of bribery in securing Tokyo Olympics sponsorship. A former chairman and two other senior officials of major business suit retailer Aoki Holdings admitted in court Thursday to having bribed a former Tokyo Olympic Organizing Committee executive to become a sponsor for the sporting event held last year. Hironori Aoki, 84, along with two others, has been charged with providing a total of $210,000 to Haruki Takahashi, a former executive with Japanese advertising giant Dentsu. Meanwhile, Sapporo's mayor halted 2030 Olympic bid promotion to reconsider tactics, and the Tokyo Olympics cost $12.9 billion, according to new figures, 20% more than the amount announced earlier this year. In the Hong Kong Free Press, what did Hong Kongers Google in 2022? COVID-related terms were among the most searched on Google in Hong Kong this year. Whitman Hung, whose birthday party emerged as a scandal during the city's fifth COVID wave, also trended as top searches. From Chief Executive John Lee to U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, the city's leader was the most searched person, followed by Eileen Gu, the U.S.-born skier who represented China in the Winter Olympics in Beijing. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest. In the Oregonian, Oregon population declined in 2022 for the first time in decades, Census Bureau says. The agency figures Oregon lost about 16,000 residents in the year leading up to July 1st, 2022, representing about 0.4% of the state's population. That puts Oregon at number 6 among the fastest shrinking U.S. states, both in percentage and numeric declines. Oregon's population is more than 4.2 million people. In the Seattle Times, Washington Supreme Court reinstates guilty verdicts in 1987 killings of Canadian couple. Tanya Van Culenborg and Jay Cook disappeared in November 1987 after leaving their home near Victoria for an overnight trip to Seattle. Their bodies were found in separate locations in northwestern Washington about a week later. William Talbot II was identified by DNA and charged in 2018, convicted by a jury in 2019, but successfully appealed in 2020. In the Times Colonist, Ireland's only West Coast intercity bus service to be suspended in January. Citing heavy financial losses, Wilson's Transportation says it will suspend its Tofino bus operations, including the Vancouver Island Connector, for 4 months starting in January. Purchased by Wilson's in 2018, Tofino Bus provides the island's only West Coast intercity bus service, offering transportation to 29 communities and 21 First Nations. In March 2021, Tofino Bus got a $1.15 million provincial subsidy to help maintain essential operations until the end of March of this year. That's Cascadia Calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. It don't matter what color you are, 'cause love will conquer hate. Virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting. Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to people making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to all the first responders, police, fire, paramedics, doctors and nurses at emergency rooms, the people in the military, all the people who can't take time off at this time of year, but have to keep our communities and country safe. Merry Christmas, Happy New Year, and thank you to all of you. You can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo Bar. Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news. Spruce Hill Contracting, custom homes and renovations. Find more information at sprucehill.ca. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of December 25th, 2022. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast in 2022, but we'll be back in 2023. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on the 25th of December in 1991, the United States recognized Ukraine as an independent nation more than 3 weeks after 92% of voters in Ukraine approved the Declaration of Independence? It triggered the dissolution of the Soviet Union. Now you know. Send me your feedback. Send me your story ideas to Bob at thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. For news as it happens, follow The Breaker News on Twitter and visit thebreaker.news on Facebook. You can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. For more information, go to patreon.com/thebreakernews. That's patreon.com/thebreakernews. Merry Christmas and Happy New Year. Until next week.